At our Christmas Eve service, I really appreciated the talk that Rod gave. He talked about the Christmas story, and I appreciated the fact that he used some language that I thought resonated so well with people. He described the story of the birth of Christ and the wise men, the magi, and Joseph and Mary in Bethlehem, and he put it all under the umbrella. He put it all under the umbrella of nonfiction. And I thought that really hits the nail on the head. That's the kind of faith that we have. We have a faith that is anchored in history. Whatever else one might want to say about the Christian faith and belief in God, it is anchored in history. And I thought Rod's use of language was just really spot on. Well, today we have a text, and the text is important because of what it purports to be. 1 Samuel 20. 1 Samuel is the Word of God. And so today we have a text that is part of God's message to God's people. What we want to do is we want to try to uncover the truth within the text. I'm not interested in being creative, overly creative. I'm not going to try and stand on my ear. My objective is to try to locate the truth within the passage, and then to bring this to the people of God. I trust that God has been with me this week as I've been reflecting and preparing, and now I want to sort of share with you. I want to offload some of this truth to the people of God, and I hope that you will be able to welcome this into your life. Well, as I've been thinking about my life this week, I'm feeling very lucky in one department in particular, one department, and that's the friendship department. We're talking about friendship today, and as I think about friendship in my life, I feel like I am very friend-rich, and I was reminded of how friendship-rich I am when I got an email from a friend of mine who lives in New Zealand. I got it last Tuesday. There were a number of things that he wanted to say to me, but just holding this email reminds me that I am a friendship-rich guy. This comes from a friend by the name of Phil. Sandy knows Phil, so this is nonfiction. This is a real person. I first met Phil in the early 70s because we both started college the same day. We were those lost freshmen who didn't know really where we fit into Providence College. And we got to know each other, and we only spent a year together because after 1 year, my friend Phil decided that college was not for him. And so he took off, and I stayed, and our lives went in some very different directions. But you know how it is with some friendships? It's like you keep weaving in and out of each other's lives, even though you live in different places of the planet. And Phil was just one of those special guys. And he eventually took a career in the national parks. He became a warden, and he moved to Jasper National Park. And by that time, we had moved back to Alberta, and we're living in Edmonton. And when Phil would come to Edmonton on business, he would get in touch with me. And when we were in the park camping or whatever we were doing there, I would get in touch with Phil. I remember worshiping one Sunday with Phil in the Little Baptist Church there in Jasper. There was a time in Phil's life when he was in a real jam, and I tried to be there for Phil. And there were some times in my life when I felt like I was really in a jam, and Phil was there for me. I remember one time Phil invited me to go to this thing called the National Final Rodeo? Like, I had never been to a rodeo before, and he had such great seats, I could almost smell those critters. They were so close. And we had a wonderful time together. Well, Phil eventually married a girl who was from New Zealand. They now live in New Zealand. There was a ministry that opened for him in a very unusual way. You may have heard that a number of years ago they had some pretty serious earthquakes in the Christchurch area, and Phil was living there. And somebody got the bright idea that what we need as a community during times like this are community chaplains. And so Phil thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. I'd like to be a community chaplain. And so he went and he took some training, and he continues to serve in that capacity now, even though the earthquakes, for the most part, have subsided. He's got a guitar and he loves to sing, and he will go to the community hall, he will go to the church, he will go to the pub, wherever the community welcomes him to come, he will come and he will try to help people and come alongside of people. Well, Phil wrote me this email, and part of the reason why he sent it to me was, he said, Terry, we've gotta start Skyping again. Last year we were Skyping, but then we had some technical difficulties. Now, I didn't know if it was on my end or if it was on Phil's end. And he writes to me, he says, I want to get back to our regular Skyping schedule if that suits you. We had a faulty line to our home, which was replaced and should end the cutting in and out of our Skype line. So it was New Zealand's fault, not Canada's fault. And so we want to begin doing that again. But the thing that sort of got my attention was the way that he signed off his letter, his email. He said, thanks for being a friend. And if you just saw those words, they wouldn't mean a lot to you because you don't know the context of what's been going on in our relationship. But some 40 years later, Phil and I get to continue our friendship. I'm not saying that our friendship is necessarily as great as the friendship that we want to look at today in 1 Samuel chapter 20. But it is a good friendship. It's a solid friendship. And today we're going to be in 1 Samuel 20, that famous friendship of David and Jonathan. We're going to talk a little bit about how it worked and what the relationship was based on. It's a famous friend story. Well, the story begins by looking at it from David's side. A little later on, we'll look at the friendship from Jonathan's side. But first of all, we're going to look at it from David's side, verses 1 to 13. Now, as all good stories often start with their foot in trouble, David's side of the story begins with some trouble. And in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 20, we read, Then David fled and went to Jonathan and asked, What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father? And his father, of course, was right, King Saul. How have I wronged your father that he is trying to kill me? Never, Jonathan replied, you are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so. But David took an oath and said, Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death. David was in trouble. David was in serious trouble. He had already been serving as a court minstrel with Saul, but something rather interesting was happening. Saul's ratings in the polls was dropping like lead, and David's poll ratings were just skyrocketing. Everybody liked David. Jonathan, the crown prince, loved David. Saul's daughter, Michal, she fell in love with David. The soldiers loved David. The officers loved David. The people loved David. Everybody loved David. And rather than Saul commending this loyal servant, he got nervous and he got paranoid. And he said, this isn't good. If everybody's loyalty is starting to envelop David, that must mean that they are no longer loyal to me. You can't be loyal to two people at one time, can you? And so he got really nervous about this and paranoid. And on at least three occasions, Samuel tells us that Saul tried to pin David to the wall with his sword or with his spear. And Saul, of course, was a formidable warrior, so that's got to be a pretty scary thing. And so David writes out of a context of trouble. He's a fugitive. I don't know if you've ever felt like a fugitive. I don't think I've ever been a fugitive of all the things that I've experienced. But David was a fugitive, and he was on the run. And remember there in verse 3 where it says, there is only one step between me and death. I'm this close. I'm just hanging. My life is hanging, you know, just by a thread. And so he now comes to Jonathan with the ask. All right, when you're in trouble, you look to people, you turn to people who can help you, and you have an ask. And David had an ask. And he came to Jonathan, verse 5, and he says, I've got a little plan here. Okay, we're going to try and keep tabs on the king, find out just where his mood is. And he says, look, tomorrow is the new moon feast, and I am supposed to dine with the king, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he says, here's the test, very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, as he is wont to do, you can be sure that he is determined to harm me. He says, keep me posted. Keep me posted on your dad's mood. Because depending upon how he acts towards my absence at this important dinner, I'll know where he's at. I'll know where the danger is. And then in verse 9, Jonathan said, if I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? So David is asking, keep me posted. I need intelligence. I need information. So David is in trouble. David brings his ask, and now he really gets to the important thing that we often overlook, and that is the reason for the ask. Why is it that David could even ask the crown prince for a favor like this? Why could he even come to a Jonathan? Why can he have a relationship with Jonathan? And in verse 8 we read, as for you, Jonathan, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you. In other words, the reason why Jonathan and I are like this is because we have a covenant of friendship. There are commitments and promises that we have made. We have obligated ourselves to each other. I don't know if people do this anymore. I know we do it in marriage. But rarely do I find friendships where there is such deep-seated loyalty to one another. They have made this covenant. They've obligated themselves to one another. David, if you're ever in a jam, I'm there for you. Jonathan, if you're ever in a jam, David is there for you. They just took things like friendship so seriously. I'm not saying that I don't think we take friendship seriously. I think we do. It's just that often we don't verbalize the stuff that passes between us. And maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea if we did that more often. Women are probably a lot better. Girls are probably a lot better at doing this than guys are. Guys, we just sort of, you know, muddle along in our relationship. And if it goes good, great. And if it doesn't go so good, well, I guess it wasn't meant to be. And maybe we're not good at verbalizing some of these things. And so the reason why David was able to come to Jonathan and ask him for help is because they had made this covenant of friendship. And you can read more about that in chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. Because on that occasion, Jonathan had come to David and had taken off his cloak and given it to David. And a lot of scholars think that this was the cloak that signified that he was the crown prince, that he was next in line. And you don't just go and you know, that's like if you're on a football team and, you know, you've got this great jacket and it says captain or quarterback or something. You don't just go and give that to somebody else. Well, he gave him his mantle, signifying his great privileged role. And he also gave him a sword, and I think he gave him some other things on that occasion as well. And that signified this covenant of friendship that existed between them. And so David now comes to Jonathan, and he's asking his friend for help. He's asking his friend for protection. Which makes me wonder, what's happening in the friendship department of our lives these days? As we stand on the threshold of 2015, we're moving into 2016. I want you to think for a moment with me about what's happening in the friendship department of our lives. How do you measure this? You know, is it about the number of Christmas cards that you get? I don't know if you got any Christmas cards this year. I know Charlie Brown, he never gets very many Christmas cards, and it's just a source of real mental stress in his life. I think people are sending fewer cards these days. Our family is really fortunate because we've got three great events that come together. We have a wedding anniversary, my wife has a birthday, and then on the heels of that, there's Christmas. And we get cards, it seems, for each of these occasions, and so we can just line them up. And when you come and you look, all you see is there's just a lot of cards. The Weeds really got a lot of Christmas cards. And they're not all Christmas cards. They're from some of these other events. But how do we measure what's happening in our lives in the friendship department? Are we approachable? I think this is one of the ways that we are able to flourish in friendship. Are we the sort of people who are available to other people? You know, they say that on everybody's face, there's either a yes or a no. My wife tells me that everybody has a resting face. Like when you're not trying to do something with your face, that's your resting face. And some people naturally have a no, and some people, good, some of you are checking that out, that's good. And some people seem to have a no. And regardless of that, that's just, you know, physiology. It may not mean a whole lot, but at an emotional level, do I communicate to people an availability or not? People pick up on stuff like that. Am I friendly? We'll talk about that in just a moment. There's more to just being friendly, but am I friendly? Do people perceive me as a friendly person? I grew up in a home where my father was incredibly friendly. And I don't know where he learned that from. I don't think he learned it from his own father, but he learned it along the way. And he's so friendly. And I think all of the kids in our family, for the most part, tend to come off as fairly friendly. Now, are we the kind of people who extend ourselves? I think that one of the ways of developing a flourishing type of friendship relationship is, you know, just, I could do that. I could be involved with you in that. And maybe you could be involved in my life as well. Sometimes I think we're rather disingenuous. I was reading one of my favorite writers recently, a John Golden Gay. He's an Old Testament specialist at a school in California, and he's from Britain. And he moved here a number of years ago, but he basically grew up and started his career as a seminary professor before he came here, and he had a complaint about Americans. And I think the complaint could probably be laid at the floor of at the feet of Canadians as well, but his complaint was that Americans that he experienced in Southern California were better at being friendly than they were at being friends. And I thought, whoa, I hope he's just imagining it. I hope that's not true. Wouldn't that be terrible if somebody said that of you, that you were a lot better at being friendly than you were at actually being a friend? A number of years ago, I read an interview from a fellow by the name of Mike Iaconelli. He was a leader in youth ministry, started a ministry called Youth Specialty. And in this interview, he was musing on the theme of friendship. And Mr. Iaconelli said, "I have three or four good friends in my life." What's your number? I have three or four good friends in my life, some of whom are 2,500 miles away. And one of these friends, he said, put it this way, "My job in life is to have six pallbearers before I die." He wants to have six really good friendships. He doesn't have them yet, but he's hoping to get them. So Mr. Iaconelli says, "I've got four out of my six, so maybe I'll stay for a while." These are the kind of people that you can just call on any time of the day. Do you have friends like that? Time's irrelevant. What's relevant is you have a need. Who cares that it's 3 or 4 a.m.? That's irrelevant. I can just pick up the phone and I can call them because there is something that has passed between us like David and Jonathan, and we can lean on each other even when it's inconvenient. I haven't done any real serious research on this, but my guess is that girls, their list of friends like that would be a lot longer than guys would be. So maybe we just need to keep working on this and, you know, keep going for our magic number of six. What's happening in the friendship department of our lives? So we've seen the story from David's side. Now we look at it from Jonathan's side in verses 14 to 17. And the outline here is basically the same. Jonathan finds himself in trouble as well. Trouble is one of the best places to test friendship. Sometimes you don't really know who your friends are until you're in a jam or until you've done something really stupid and you've been caught and it's not good for you and now you find out who your friends are. What's the trouble that Jonathan is in? The text actually only implies it. But if we know about the history of the day, if we know about the political practices of the day, we understand that Jonathan finds himself in a very vulnerable place. It has to do with the kind of vulnerability that a crown prince would experience during a time of regime change. You've got one king, he's done, and now there's another king who's being brought to the throne. And the former king now finds himself in a very vulnerable situation. Why? Well, it's because of what new kings often did. Do you know what new kings often did in the ancient Near East? They liquidated all their rivals. They exercised their kingly prerogative and they wiped them all out. That's what you did. You didn't want anybody to be able to challenge your kingship. And so, for instance, if we turn to 1 Kings 15, which I won't right now. Oh, actually, I will. I've got it right here. 1 Kings 15. As soon as he, it says, who was Baasha. Baasha was the new king. The old king was Nadab, and before him was Jeroboam. As soon as Baasha began to reign, he killed Jeroboam's whole family. He did not leave Jeroboam anyone that breathed, but destroyed them all. So then Baasha rules for a while, and then Elah becomes king. And then after Elah, there's another king by the name of Zimri. And in 1 Kings 16, we see him liquidating all the competition. As soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne, he killed off Baasha's whole family. He did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. So where does Jonathan find himself? He has already recognized that the kingship is not going to follow the lines of heredity. It's not going from Saul to Jonathan, right? God is giving the kingship to who? David. So what does that make Jonathan and his whole family? There's some rival stuff going on here. And so Jonathan now comes to David with his ask in verses 14 and 15. He says, "But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed." Why is he worried about living? Because he understands what happens so often in the ancient Near East. New kings kill off all their rivals. Verse 15, "And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family." So his ask is, David, when you become king, be the exception. Don't be like other ancient Near Eastern kings. Be the exception. And you may remember that be the exception is sort of the theme that we've been trying to develop in our 1 Samuel series. First, we met Samuel. Samuel was an exception to the order of the day. The order of the day during the period of the judges was that everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. That was the norm. And so Samuel was the exception. And if you've ever read the Old Testament book of Ruth, Ruth was an exception as well. She didn't live according to that self-serving philosophy. And so now Jonathan says, "David, you be the exception in the way that you treat the royal family." So we've seen his trouble, and now we've seen his ask. And now we come back to the reason for the ask in verses 16 and 17. What gives the weaker party, which is now Jonathan, what gives the weaker party the audacity to come to the stronger party, which will be David, and to ask for such a favor? Well, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. There's the word. He made a covenant. It was a covenant of friendship. We've exchanged promises. I've obligated myself to you, and you have obligated yourself to me. And now we have the basis for friendship. We have the basis for deep relationship. And that's why he was able to ask his friend David for help and for preservation. Well, the story highlights what we might call uncommon kindnesses. And our temptation is when we see a relationship that has such beautiful friendship, displays of friendship, we want to stay there on the surface. And I think the author of this passage says, good, enjoy what's on the surface, enjoy the favors that are being shared, but don't forget to go below the surface to the foundation of these uncommon kindnesses at all. If uncommon kindness between people is a measure of solid friendship and relationship, what might that look like for us? Where is it in our world that uncommon kindness is needed? Well, one of the places where it's needed, of course, is in marriage and family. I've been using a commentary on 1 Samuel by Dale Ralph Davis, and just the way that the author is described, I think he's now a retired seminary professor who lives in the woods, somewhere in the deep south. And I imagine he would have quite an accent if we could hear him speak. But in his commentary at this point, he breaks away from the story and he says, I have seen uncommon kindness in my lifetime. I have seen it in my own family. I have seen it in my mother's care of my father in his last days as his health, but particularly his mind began to slip. That doesn't take much to imagine a situation like that, right? We have a congregation where there are a lot of us who are in the third of our lives, and we're seeing some of these storylines playing out. 9 months after my father died, my mother died. Partly, he says, because she felt she could. She had accomplished her mission, taking care of her husband. Not sensational or glamorous. Didn't read about it in Time magazine or McLean's magazine. It wasn't sensation or glamorous, but it was, he says, covenantal. It had something to do with in sickness and in health. Something about covenant, something about commitment, something about promise. These promises that had passed between these two people on their wedding day and then reaffirmed throughout the course of their life, translated into what? Uncommon kindness. What a wonderful thing it is to see. Uncommon kindness is needed in our marriages. It's also needed in the what I like to call the vicissitudes of life. Not just some words, they just kind of roll off your tongue so nicely. Vicissitude. And vicissitude has to do with the ebb and flow of life. Good times, bad times, in-between times. We need uncommon kindness in places like that. Like when a loss sidelines us. Not long ago, the lady, Deb, as many of us know her, works in our church office, had some health issues, and she lost some time at work. And thankfully, we have some short-term disability with our insurance company, but they don't cover everything. And so even though there were going to be some payments, there was going to be a shortfall at the same time. And so the leadership of Balmoral came to the congregation and said, here is the situation. What do you think we could do? The good news is, you know, we have an opportunity to help Deb. The downside is that if you write any checks, we can't give you a receipt for certain legal reasons. So what did people do? Well, Balmoral did what Balmoral always does when somebody is in a jam. They stepped up and people started writing checks and they got behind Deb and they provided her not only with the amount that she needed to make up for the difference, but the congregation went over and above. And I tell you, she was just whistling in the office there for a couple of days. So good on the people of God when they fulfill these kinds of either implied or express obligations that we have toward one another. It's not that long ago, my father was dying in Abbotsford, British Columbia, and I had gone there a couple of times just to visit him briefly, but we all kind of knew where this was going. And so the leadership of the church basically said to me, you go. You just go. You go and grieve. You go and help. You go and be a son and whatever else you might need to be. And I did. And amazingly, all the bills got paid. The provision was there. These are uncommon kindnesses that happen during the vicissitudes of life, during the up and down of life. And you know, I'm convinced that today, wherever you live, whatever the name of your neighborhood is, mine is Rosedale, your neighborhood has a different name, there are people who before the end of the year or early in the new year will have some trouble in their life. And they will need someone to slip beside them and to show them an uncommon kindness. There is someone where you work who has trouble in their lives and they need someone to come alongside them and to show them an uncommon kindness. There is someone where you play at the gym or the cross-country ski club that you're a part of or wherever it is that you do your play and recreation. They will need an uncommon kindness. Would we be in a place where we could do that for them, where we could offer that to them the way that it has been offered to us? Two things from this passage that really stand out for me. One is, friends ask friends for help. Friends ask friends for help. If you're my friend, all right, the day should come when I'm asking you for some help. If I'm your friend, the day should come when you're asking me for some help, because that's what friends do. Friends ask friends for help. So whoever it is that you put in this circle of friendship, I'd encourage you to test it by that criteria. Friends ask friends for help. And the other thing is that such friendship really has to rest on something much more substantial than a good feeling. I get such a good feeling whenever I'm around you. Well, that's maybe not a bad thing, but for those of us who are married, you know, for more than a week, a month, a year, a decade, we know that feelings come and feelings go, but commitments stay, right? Commitments stay. I am committed to you. You are committed to me. So the feeling may be there, the feeling may not be there, but I'm safe. I'm safe in my relationship with you because there's a commitment. If there's no commitment, then the whole friendship thing is in jeopardy. It's on really, really shaky ground, and we don't want that. And then the wonderful thing about this thing called commitment is that it becomes the soil out of which uncommon kindness can grow. It usually doesn't happen overnight, but over time, it's the place where deep friendship and deep relationship would happen. When Paul wanted to summarize uncommon kindness, of course, his mind went straight to the cross. And in Titus chapter 3, he wrote words something like, "But when the kindness of God our Savior and his love for mankind appeared, he saved us." That is the ultimate uncommon kindness. And this time of year, of course, we remember the coming of Christ as a baby. And we know that Christ grew up and became an adult. And he died on the cross, and he was raised back to life. And as we think about the whole life of Jesus from beginning to end, we need to be thinking about kindness. This is a demonstration of God's kindness. This is his uncommon kindness to uncommonly wicked and sinful people like you and I. And it's God's way of opening the door to relationship with us. Have you been through that door? Christ stands there every day, waiting, waiting, and waiting for people to come through the doorway. Today could be your day. Come through the doorway. Hurry. Because it'll close. It's not a door of opportunity that is there forever. But it's open right now. It's wide open right now. And you need to come through that. Come on through. Sometimes you're at the mall and the door's starting to close, and we used to say to our kids, "Come on, come on, come on, get through." So this is what we need to say to each other. Come on. Come on through. Trust in Christ. Believe in Christ.